listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 11. In today's episode, I've got an amazing interview with you with someone who I really admire and respect. His name is Martin Griffin, and he's a teacher with 20 years experience teaching GCSE and A-level, some of which as head of sixth form. And he's made a really in-depth study with his colleague, Stephen Oakes, on how to really succeed at A-level and published a book called The A-Level Mindset. And his second book, The GCSE Mindset, is coming out soon. Now, in this episode, he shares his model for success at A-level, which is called the VESPA model, V-E-S-P-A, and you'll learn all about it in the episode. But for any students or parents who is stepping up to A-level this academic year, then this is an absolute must listen to, because everything that Martin shares is really, really going to help you succeed. Thanks for listening. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Martin Griffin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here, Martin. Firstly, Martin, can you tell us a little bit about your time working in schools and how you came up with a formula for helping students to succeed at A-level?
Sure, yeah. My background is 20 years of teaching both GCSE and A-level, predominantly in sixth form colleges, but more recently in 11 to 18 environments. And I've become really interested over, particularly over the last 5 or 6 years, in the non-cognitive skills that promote academic success. And what I mean by non-cognitive are a set of perhaps characteristics, behaviours, attitudes and approaches to study, which promote a kind of accelerated learning, which means that students who have these characteristics and qualities are far better able to cope with some of the setbacks and tragedies that you come across as you try and master a new set of material and skills in a post-16 course.
Okay, fantastic. So I know your work, your book and my book mirror each other a little bit, but I'm really interested to see, you know, what you think are those characteristics that really make the difference for making some students really successful at A-level and kind of others kind of getting caught up or left behind by whatever is thrown at them during those 2 years.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out to begin with that there's huge amounts of research focusing on non-cognitive skills and their impact on academic attainment, but it can be a bit of a jungle to hack your way through when you're reading fabulous academic studies about the impact of, say, persistence, mm-hmm. or reliability or conscientiousness or self-efficacy. There are all sorts of studies that pick out individual characteristics or thematically connected sets of characteristics and go on to prove or evidence some really exciting impacts between those non-cognitive skills and academic outcomes. The problem is, I think, for, say, teachers or parents who are trying to explore this unfamiliar region for the first time, is that it feels often like there are myriad possibilities when it comes to characteristics. If you look at some of the work done by the Jubilee Centre at the Birmingham University, Jubilee Centre for Characters and Virtues, they, for example, will focus on 18 characteristics. So one of the issues I found as I was exploring non-cognitive skills and their impact on academic success was paring down the huge array of characteristics and skills that were explored and discussed in academic journals and trying to create a kind of manageable package that we could support in young people. So that's a long way of saying that the ones that we find most important in our work are vision, first of all, students who have a strong sense of commitment to a particular direction or who at least know why they're taking the courses they're taking and the grades they want at the end, tend to outperform those who don't have that.
Definitely. Yeah, that's something that I really find in my work as well, that vision, I mean, it was important for me, and I found that you really engage and motivate students by helping them to clarify what their vision is.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a huge long-term commitment to a project either. You look at the work of someone like Angela Lee Duckworth, she'll say, well, commitment to a long-term goal is a key characteristic. But we've managed to support students with kind of sequential short-term goals in just as effective a way, as long as there is something to which the student aims.
Can you give an example of one of those short-term goals that really worked for students that you worked with?
Yeah, I was working with a group of students who were feeling very uncertain about why they were engaged in post-16 education and what it was going to do for them ultimately. They weren't entirely sure whether it was going to be a university course, a job, or whatever. In those circumstances, I found conversations around where do you see yourself in 2 or 3 years' time, or what do you want to have achieved by the time you're 21, or what job might you like? That they're particularly slippery and tricky questions to try and get to the bottom of. Mm-hmm. However, something like this, well, your next report goes home to your parents in 6 weeks. Let's talk about what the ideal report would look like for you. What grades might the teachers have specified in that report? What comments might they have made about your approach to study? What strengths might they have picked out as they review the last half term and make some summative kind of assessment of where you're up to? And students are often able to say, well, I can tell you what that looks like. Yeah, I know where I want to be by half term.
That's really interesting that works as an approach, because when I was at school, the report would be motivating. I would want it to reflect that I was doing well, but it would have to fit into that bigger picture of the direction that I was going in. And it just feels quite strange that just external validation of the report is sufficient to keep them motivated.
That's one example for how you might string together a sequence of short-term aims as a kind of proxy for a longer-term sense of direction. Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that that is a permanent state of affairs, but that it works as a surrogate for something more permanent that might be working its way through cognitively through the kind of the mind of the kid as you support them in these short-term aims and objectives.
Okay, well, that's all about vision, so having this kind of what's it all for kind of sense in each of the young people that are in a class, or for the parents, their young people who are going through the exams. What are the other characteristics that you identified?
We've looked very closely at effort, by which we mean the hours of independent study, including homework, that a student does per week. We've been particularly interested in that measure and trying to draw parallels between that particular input, the hours of independent study per week, including homework, and the outcomes in terms of grades. And there have been some very broad thematic links between effort and outcome that have helped us kind of clarify a narrative with young people. Often in the student body, the belief is not that effort is a key component of success, but that some genetic predisposition to success is what's happened. So often in the student, in the mind of the student, or in the collective student consciousness, the story goes, well, certain students have a savant, you know, they have this they just have this innate talent in maths or chemistry or biology or English or whatever it might be. And therefore, low levels of effort don't matter in kids like that, because they succeed regardless. We became really interested in trying to expose this as a myth. And it's been really interesting sitting down with students, asking how hard they work, and then correlating that with their outcomes. We've found very, very vanishingly few examples of students who do exceptionally well on what they report to us as being low levels of independent study.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I was having a conversation with one of my coaching clients the other day. He's just finishing year 10 and he's just got his exam results. And there are various subjects that he really struggles with, like languages and English, the more kind of written subjects. He loves the more mathsy subjects. And he just said there's some guys in his class who just seem to be able to do it without any effort. And I said to him, are you absolutely sure about that? Because you have no idea what they are actually doing when they go home from school and how much they study and that kind of thing. And it's true that some people are going to find some subjects easier than others, but if you're hitting the top grades, it's going to be very, very rare that that's happening without any effort at all, isn't it?
Yeah, we've found so few examples of that as to be unhelpful, really. It's not worth sharing them with students. There have been so few. What we have found is that when we interview a student who others will describe as, let's say, a maths genius, you know, they'll say, well, the thing about this guy is he's just awesome at maths. When we then sit with that student and ask them precisely how they work, how hard they work, when they work, what kind of activities they do, what we find instead is a kind of disciplined, high effort existence, which means that there's just a very intense focus on the subject. And mastery has resulted from kind of extensive practice over a period of time. It's true, I guess, referring back to your client, your year 10 client, that once a student becomes very practiced in something, there's a kind of fluid effortlessness in how it appears to others, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely.
I think that supports the kind of myth that it can be achieved with very little input.
Yeah. It's just that question all the time as well. It's just like, do you really know what they're doing and how they're doing it at home? And the number of people I've worked with now who've believed that they're not very good at things, but then when they start putting in consistent effort, they start seeing better results. And that, you know, that changes their mind about their own talents. So it is effort most of the time that I find that makes the difference, not just in results, but in how the students view themselves.
Yeah, I'd agree. The impact on their sense of efficacy and agency is can be very, very strong. Interestingly about effort, it's worth pointing out that effort alone is not enough.
No.
And that auditing precisely what students are doing when they work independently was an important step for us. And we'll perhaps touch on that later on.
Okay. So we've chatted about effort there. I know you're kind of building towards your, is it 5-step model?
Yeah.
So what's the next thing, the next characteristic that you emphasise with students and in schools?
Well, the word we use for it is systems, and what we use, that word for us really means a set of tools and strategies and tactics for organising time and resources. So it's useful to think of it in terms of organisation, really. I'll give you an example, I think, that might clarify what I mean here. Low systems students find it hard to make connections between material and see a subject holistically, because they haven't got a sufficiently organized network of resources that allow them to make those kind of those intellectual connections between subsections of the course. Often what's happened with pupils in Key Stage 3 and 4 is that they've arranged their learning chronologically. They've used an exercise book. Typically, that's what's going to happen at high school. They'll be given an exercise book of lined A4 paper, and as teachers we're going to stand up and say, right, September, here's the date, here's your title, and let's begin. And what you have over the period of Key Stage 4 is a chronological account of what's happened in class.
Now
I think what post-16 study requires is a thematic account of what's been learnt, not a chronological account. So what we're trying to do is to shift students who have been used to organising themselves chronologically and therefore find a kind of conceiving of the course as a whole quite challenging, to students who are going to take on a much more in-depth, intellectually challenging course, and will need to organise their material thematically or in modular units that relate to each other in certain ways. What we found with low system students is they either cleave towards the notion that they should continue organising their material chronologically and therefore struggle to see the big picture, or they have no experience of organising themselves any other way, and often lose learning materials or don't know where to put learning materials. I think if we thought of low system students as low attendance, we would be much quicker in intervening. But because the child has been in the classroom, we've seen them there 97 or 98% of the times we've been there, you know, attendance has been good. Mm-hmm. We assume records of learning are therefore good, and there isn't necessarily a connection between the two. Low system students perhaps have records of 65 to 70% of their classes, and so their poor performance isn't a result of kind of some cognitive issue. Instead, it's about making connections between learning and trying to plug gaps in a kind of conception of how the course works, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, so on a kind of practical level, if we're talking to parents about how they can actually help their children with the systems aspect of things, like, is the first step just making sure that they have all the notes from all the lessons in their folder in a sensible order? Is that the kind of first step to being a decent system student?
That's one of the steps, yeah. I mean, what we've focused on, I suppose, over the last 2 or 3 minutes of talking is on organisation of resources, mm-hmm. but systems also includes organisation of time. Mm-hmm. So if you think of it as those, the kind of twin prongs of organisation, being able to collect and capture resources in a kind of logical and understandable way, but then also being able to manage a sequence of events over a period of time. So it would be about organizing files and folders, obviously, but it would also then be to do with sequencing streams of work so that students are enabled and move away from a position of reactivity. The teacher tells me to do something, and just before the deadline, I rush it off. Mm-hmm. That might be happening in Key Stage 4, to a kind of proactive and strategic organisation of work, which comes through the use of a number of kind of tools and strategies from project management, for example.
Yeah. So, yeah, you have to think very much like, if you've got a big piece of work, like an EPQ to do, how are you going to budget your time over the weeks and months to get that piece of work done, like do the research and then do your plan and, you know, get it written so that it actually gets done and handed in on time without a mad rush at the end. That's the kind of thing you're talking about, isn't it?
I am. I'm really interested in the opportunities we've given to young people, or rather not given to young people, to proactively project manage during Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4. Mm. I think that the tendency of schools, for very good reasons, I must say, is to micromanage the student experience through Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4, and then, for better or for worse, kind of expect a set of skills to emerge very quickly at Key Stage 5 that haven't been used or practiced at all up to that point. Now, what you mentioned there, Lucy, is a kind of quite high level of strategic operation in which a student can conceive of an entire project and, I suppose, design for themselves a set of delivery points at which they're going to make a personal commitment to have finished a certain amount. And that might have been something that you developed early yourself, mm-hmm. and allowed you to achieve everything that you've achieved. But for certain students, that seems it's almost like magic. How on earth am I going to get this to happen? So I think we need to explicitly teach a set of skills associated with project management, time management and resource management.
For me it's an absolute tragedy the way that coursework has been stripped away, particularly at GCSE, because, you know, I started to learn those skills. I remember doing my GCSE geography coursework, which was a big independent piece of research that I had to organize and, you know, conceive of organise, manage, and see through right to the end myself. And that was the first time I really had to do something like that. And if we're not giving students those opportunities at GCSE, and, you know, in some ways, because the removal of a lot of coursework at A-level is, you know, that's removed as well, they're not getting that experience until they're actually at university. And I think we really are doing students a disservice through that. I don't know what your opinions are on that.
Well, I'm quite an advocate for teaching these non-cognitive skills, not just for performance during the key stage in which they're taught, but for performance afterwards. And I'm interested in the way you've referred to university there, because if you check the Higher Education Statistics Authority, HESA, really interesting data on their website. Unfortunately, pretty difficult to dig through, but there are some fascinating observations to be made about student dropout rates at university, particularly with students from a lower socioeconomic strata, as it were, from more complex socioeconomic backgrounds. These are students who might not have the kind of experience of self-management, self-regulation and organisation that we're talking about, and dropout rates are higher for those students. And they are rising as well. 8.2% in 2014 of students from those backgrounds dropped out in the first year of their university course, rising to 8.8% in 2015. We're waiting for the 2016 data now, and I see no reason why it shouldn't continue to creep upwards, because the micromanagement of the student experience during key stage 3, 4, and 5 means that we haven't adequately prepared learners to cope with that greater degree of independence they get post 18.
Yeah, it's a tragedy, isn't it? And I can remember somebody say, a student who'd just gone into year 12 saying to me, we were spoon fed at GCSE and they've just taken it away now, and I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to cope. And, you know, I think schools are doing it because they want to get the children results, but that, in my opinion, they're almost false results when the children have been helped to that degree, because they haven't shown the kind of personal resources and characteristics that you would expect to be reflected by the higher grades. I don't know what your opinion is on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you expressed that extremely well. There is a, I don't want to give the impression that the school is willfully damaging future progress. Of course, that behaviours like this from schools come from very high levels of accountability about student outcome, and you know that, that there's a, we could argue about that until the cows came home, couldn't we? Extent to which you need to manage the delivery of curriculum in schools by raising the level of accountability. And introducing more regular assessment from Ofsted and other kind of bodies, equivalent bodies.
Yeah.
But the outcome often is a short-termism. We're going to be assessed on student performance at 16, and therefore everything we do should be about that particular outcome. And we've ended up in this curious position where one key stage, or the set of skills and attributes taught during one key stage, don't seem to connect with the set of skills and attributes expected at the following key stage. Which is why I'm particularly interested in the notion that past performance does not equal future performance. That's a perhaps another one of those myths that students too readily believe.
Yeah.
When in fact you can say, well, no, each key stage is being taught, delivered and tested in a very different way. So
yeah,
I need to disconnect the notion that performance at key stage 4 is going to predetermine performance at key stage 5.
Yeah, and I've seen students this year who have performed exceptionally well at GCSE, but then have gone on to struggle in year 12. And, it's for all sorts of different reasons. But, you know, just because you managed to hit the high spots at one level doesn't mean it's not a pre-written conclusion that it's going to happen with the next round of exams.
No, that's right. And so there is often a certain feeling of complacency amongst students who feel almost fated to achieve well because they have a mental model that, right, past performance equals future performance. I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm going to be okay. At the bottom end, of course, or rather at the other end, you get students whose performance has been modest, that might disappoint them personally at key stage four, and they feel despondent, you know, fated to underperform a second time, and that's very much not the case. So I mean, you've just described a student who's done particularly well at one key stage who seems to hit a ceiling at the following key stage. The opposite is also possible, isn't it? A student whose performance has been modest at one key stage makes a sudden breakthrough at the next.
Yeah, and it can be to do with all sorts of different things, like maturity levels and, you know, when individuals mature, and things like how they can flourish and grow with particular teaching styles. Like, some children will respond very well to the very didactic, you know, this is what you need to know, go away and learn it, kind of sequence of events that you see at GCSE, whereas others will respond much better to the kind of more independent style of learning and kind of greater level of creativity that's demanded at A level. And so, and whereas the kind of really micromanaged style of things at GCSE will have kind of stifled them and stifled their interests. So it can come from all sorts of different angles, can't it?
It can, yeah. Certainly can.
Okay, well, we've covered three of these things in your model: vision, effort and systems. What are the final two, Martin?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on something I mentioned earlier, and that is the notion that effort alone isn't sufficient to ensure success. The fourth element that particularly fascinates us is practice. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of shorthand term for what students are doing with their independent learning, what precisely they are spending their time doing when they learn independently. I've become particularly interested in high effort students who underperform in exams and why that might be. And of course, my focus is always on non-cognitive skills, qualities, attributes, characteristics. So I tend not to think of high effort students underperforming for any cognitive or intellectual reason. Let's set that one aside. Instead, I would argue they're working in a certain way that doesn't promote a kind of resilient, flexible and creative understanding of the subject. So I think the best way to explain this quickly and simply is that there is, let's imagine, a difference between information and knowledge. Okay, on the one hand, you've got information, disconnected and rote learned set of facts, yeah, and figures. Okay, on the other hand, you have knowledge, that is information plus experience. Knowledge is flexible, responsive, creative, manipulable, plastic,
yeah,
and can be, and it is mobile and proactive and problem solving.
Yeah.
So what we've found with low practice students is that they see retention of information as sufficient for practice to stop. Okay, mm-hmm. I have memorized everything I need to for geography or German or French or chemistry. I have the information in my head, therefore everything is going to be fine. The high practice student knows that having the information in your head is only the first step, and kind of forging that information, transferring it into knowledge by using what is knowledge? Okay. It's information plus experience. It is using a set of memorized information to then critically assess a set of circumstances, or solve a problem, or build an argument.
Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting. I got Nick Shepley, who is a history tutor, to write a blog post for me about how to write a good history essay, and I'll link to that in the show notes. And he was talking about a history essay is not about facts, regurgitated facts. It's about the argument, and the facts support the argument that you make. But unless you understand the facts and you understand the implications of the facts, you can't string together this argument. So history students really need to make this kind of mental shift from thinking it's all about learning dates and facts and figures and all that kind of thing, to actually learning the sweep of history and being able to construct an argument about their opinion of what happened and use a smaller number of facts and figures in order to support that argument. And I think that goes for any essay-based subject as well as it does for history, that it's about having that argument and that kind of synthesis of understanding which you support with the facts that are available to you.
So that means, doesn't it, that once you've retained the facts, you then need to begin to develop a set of skills associated with those facts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you've expressed that really well. There's a difference between knowing and doing. And I think as a teacher, my tendency at Key Stage 3 was often to stop classes mid activity or towards the end of a particular activity and say, right, everybody, pens out, you need to know this. And we would all dutifully record an observation or a kind of fact or a lesson that we'd extracted from whatever had been going on. But that phrase, you need to know this, became a kind of shorthand that I repeated quite a lot in Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4 classes. So in a sense, I'd kind of created the problem myself. Mm. The narrative in the lesson was always, let's write this down, we need to know this. I'm more interested at Key Stage 5 in you need to be able to do this. In other words, the focus moves from information to manipulable, skill-based application of information.
Can we link this into the Power Hour and explain to people who are listening who haven't come across the Power Hour before what it is and how it helps with this kind of practice aspect?
Yes. Yeah, the Power Hour is a kind of playful term given to a particular way of revising. It was first coined by my co-writer, Steve Oakes, who loves the idea of the Power Hour. It emerged from an observation that we made of Key Stage 5 learners that good practice meant moving through three steps. Step number one was gathering and mastering the information. There you go. You learn the stuff. That's only one of three steps, of course. And what we found with some students was their conception of learning was only that. So they were only doing a third of the job.
Mm-hmm.
So step number one, you master the information. Step number two, you turn the information into knowledge by kind of forging it under high stakes practice. You might take an exam question that you find difficult, that makes you feel uncomfortable. That's key, actually, to good practice, that you are operating somewhere slightly uncomfortable and you're not convinced you're going to be able to do it. I think that's a good character, a good kind of emotional space to aim for.
Yeah.
So step two, you do something with this information. You manipulate it. You use it to answer a question, solve a problem, construct an argument, evaluate someone else's opinion, whatever. In other words, you're doing an exam question, a high-stakes exam question.
Yep.
Step three, you take the work that has emerged from stage two and you assess its quality. You get some feedback on it, either through a mark scheme, an examiner's report, a peer marking, or teacher assessment. And the feedback will tell you to either return to step one, your understanding of the information isn't strong enough, or it will tell you to return to step two. You understand the information, but your execution of a set of skills associated with that information isn't strong enough.
Yeah.
So a Power Hour would be three 20-minute sections, for example, in which a student might work through the content associated with a small amount of the syllabus for 20 minutes, answer an exam-based question for 20 minutes, and then assess the quality of that piece of work for 20 minutes by rereading it, comparing it to another piece of work, looking at an examiner's report or a mark scheme. And that revision Power Hour would then feed into what was necessary in the next session, either a focus on skill or a return to learning content.
Yeah.
So that became a kind of shorthand illustration of what we meant by moving through three phases of practice.
Yeah, and I should say here that for parents who want to go into that in more detail, I wrote a blog post about it and it's got an infographic on it which is incredibly popular, breaking down the Power Hour. It's actually into five different sections, so I will link to that in the show notes because
Excellent.
It's changed, you know, revision practice massively for so many students who've read that blog post. I'd say hundreds, if not thousands, of students. And I, all the credit goes to Martin and Steve, his co-author, for that. The other thing I should say...
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
You came up with the term. I was doing something similar before I heard the term, but you actually came up with the term and kind of clarified it. So all the credit should go to you. I think the
Well done, Steve, we'll say, shall we?
Okay,
yeah.
Well done, Steve. Pat him on the back. So one thing I should say, though, is that a lot of students come to me and they say things like, I'm doing hundreds of past papers and I'm not seeing any improvement in my grades. And the thing that I always turn around to them and say is, are you marking your own work? And they say, no, I'm not. And it's the students who take that uncomfortable step of marking their own work that and learn to analyse what they're writing and view it through the eyes of the examiner that really make those big leaps forward. And it is very uncomfortable. It's firstly uncomfortable putting yourself in that difficult situation of answering an exam question, but it's even more uncomfortable making a judgment on your own work, particularly if you're not comfortable with the mark schemes and how they're structured and what they mean and all that kind of thing. But the only way to get comfortable with that is by actually going through this process over and over again. And so I just wanted to highlight that at that this point in time, because there's practice and then there's practice, and that the really good practice is the practice that really gets you into that mindset of how the people who are going to be marking the work will view what you personally have written.
That's right. There's a kind of there's a level above mechanically completing past paper questions. What we found with our high practice students is their volume of practice is higher, of course, they do more of it, but they live in the feedback zone, content, skills, feedback we just talked about, and they very critically and strategically assess the feedback they're getting and begin to obsess about the mistakes they're making so that they can move away from kind of habitually repeating errors towards strategically picking apart an error and extracting the learning from it. So I think that kind of ties into what you've said there about high practice students living with the kind of ego threatening potential of very closely examining mistakes, errors. Yeah,
and I think that's really interesting that you use the phrase ego threatening, because that is exactly what it is. And I think it's the students who have the more fragile egos who set up the walls around themselves so they don't put themselves in these uncomfortable situations, and they don't expose themselves to getting tricky comments and that kind of thing on their work. They kind of shy away from that. It's the ones who are more in themselves confident, like deep down, who are able to stretch into these outside their comfort zones into this more difficult stuff. And I think that's quite interesting, also linking back to what you were saying earlier about students with maybe lower socioeconomic backgrounds and maybe not having that kind of emotional resilience to cope with this tricky work.
That's an interesting point. I'm not sure socioeconomic background might have a very strong relationship with resilience. For example, we've seen students who struggle with that kind of part of their personality, that element of their character from all walks of life. But I think you're dead right about the ego-threatening nature of certain kinds of work. I'll give you one example. Some students will have become quite adept at avoiding the ego-threatening zone of practice by, for example, saying something like this: well, I can't do an exam paper yet because I haven't finished memorizing the entire course. So job number one, I'm going to revise the entire course from start to finish.
Yeah.
And only when I've completed that extensive piece of work will I consider visiting the kind of practice zone two, where I begin to look at what the exam might demand. Whereas high practice students are moving continually from, right, I think I've got this small part of the course. My next job is to fill it a set of exam papers so that I've got just the questions that relate to this part of the course. And then I'm just going to try these questions and get feedback on these. So that there are there's an element of kind of micro practice in the high practice student. They're very happy to disassemble an exam paper and try it bit by bit. One of the kind of protective or defensive strategies of the low practice student is thinking they have to do an entire exam at once.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And yeah, it is a matter of confidence, but I also think it's a matter of being given permission to do that. And I think a lot of students don't realise that they are allowed to break an exam paper apart and do it in its like separate little bits, or that they are allowed to start practicing exam questions before they know every single fact that they've been taught on their 2 years studying for their A-level, you know. And I think it's just really valuable to tell them that not just that it's a good idea, but it is allowed, and that is, you know, it should be encouraged.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, shall we move on to the letter A, which is the last of your five character traits?
Yeah, the A stands for attitude, and this is perhaps the area that might be more familiar to people who've read the work of someone like Carol Dweck or Angela Lee Duckworth. We've used attitude as a kind of catch-all phrase, meaning a set of characteristics and beliefs that influence the student's perception of the learning process. So here we might include the student's conception of the relative plasticity of their brain, you know, whether their growth or fixed mindset, whether they feel as if further effort and practice are going to result in greater levels of attainment. Some students are quite loyal to the notion that they only have a fixed amount of talent or ability in a certain subject, for example. So let me talk about low attitude students. They might, for example, believe work should be easy. Okay, I should be finding courses easy because that confirms that I have the innate talent and ability to do well in them. The minute I'm finding something challenging, it's beginning to steer me very quickly towards the conclusion that I'm running short on a kind of finite amount of ability in this subject. I used to find maths easy. Now I find maths hard. Conclusion, I've come to the end of my supply, as it were, of maths ability. So what we often find with low attitude students is they've reached this uncomfortable conclusion that they can no longer do something, and are doing their very best to hide from teachers, tutors and parents the fact that they're finding something hard, because that will mean, you know, my job now is for other people not to find me out.
That's so really interesting, that observation. Yeah. It really stands out to me that one of the parents in my Facebook group, just before the most recent lot of GCSEs and A-levels started, said that her daughter had suddenly come to her 2 weeks before her English Literature GCSE exam and said, "I've been struggling since February. And I just don't know how to tackle this subject. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing." And it caused this huge panic in their household. And I just wondered there if you have any insight, A, into why students want to hide it rather than kind of confess to it. And secondly, why, how the adults in their lives can kind of unpick that before it gets the crisis situation.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think a simple way into this might be to explore ideas of let's take the imposter syndrome, okay? Mm-hmm. This is something that's written about and discussed quite often, isn't it? Particularly with creatives, you know, painters, novelists, artists will say, it's only a matter of time before people find me out. I'm not as good as everybody's telling me I am. Everyone sometimes experiences imposter syndrome, and I distinctly remember feeling as a learner myself. And young people are understandably going to hit points in their lives when they think, I don't really belong here. I don't belong in this set or this group. Other people get this in a way that I don't. And it's only a matter of time before I'm discovered, you know, before my lack of ability is exposed. Now, that is a frightening prospect, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So often the response is, I didn't really understand any of what happened in today's lesson. My solution to that problem is to pretend I did and to kind of hope it isn't discussed again.
Hope it goes away, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. So often low attitude students will do as much as they can to disguise these issues. There's another approach psychologically that some low attitude students take, and that is a very public self-sabotage. You might come across this as well. The student's declaration that, for example, very publicly so that peers, friends and the rest of the class can hear it. I'm not going to do any work for the test that's coming up next week. Insert explanation why. I can't be bothered, I don't care, or I'm afraid I'm really busy this weekend and I'm just not going to be able to do any preparation for this test. It's a kind of public declaration that says, when I get a poor grade in this, I want everyone to know that it's because I wasn't interested, bothered, or sufficiently motivated to do any work. That's the narrative they want people to pick up on. Because obviously the counter narrative, I'm not sure I yet understand the work, is a very uncomfortable thing to admit. So there are lots of ways in which, understandably, young learners are hiding their sense that they might be finding things challenging. Here's a way of kind of tackling it, and I think that's rebranding challenge as something that is interesting and important, and in fact essential to good learning. Mm-hmm. So something that I can do as a teacher, and that you can do as a coach, is to say to young people, you should be finding your courses hard. These are important courses that are testing a range of kind of skills and knowledge. They should be difficult. If they're not difficult, perhaps you're not yet operating at the edge of your ability, and you need to find the bits of the course that push you to that place. Now, not every student genuinely finds every GCSE course hard, but to begin a conversation by saying these courses should be difficult. Difficult is normal. That's where we should be.
Yeah.
And one of the metaphors we use, that we took from Dan Coyle's excellent book, The Talent Code, was the notion of operating at the edge of your ability. You mentioned comfort zones earlier, and I think this notion of finding the edge of your ability and spending as much time there as you can, as being that's the area where growth occurs,
definitely,
where accelerated learning occurs. And so I think when we're framing discussions with young people about what they're finding hard, what they're on top of, what the challenges they're facing, we should constantly frame it in terms of where is the challenge, and how often are you going there? Because you need to be living in that place.
I think this is really interesting, because a lot of the kind of sentiments that I got from parents over exam season, over the last exam season, was that these exams are too hard. Why are they making these exams so hard for our children? And it's almost like it's unfair to put them through something so difficult. And I think if you turn that around and you think, well, what are these exams for, really? It's kind of, for me, very much my personal view is that it's not just about knowledge and showing what you know in particular subjects, but each individual grade shows an awful lot about an individual's character. And so if you're getting an A star, that shows that you've put in the effort, that you've got yourself organised, you've done the necessary practice, and you've got a good attitude, like all those things that you're talking about. And to me, that person is a much more successful person because they've got those personal characteristics that have enabled them to get that grade. And if it's not difficult, these things aren't going to be tested and explored in individuals. And I think that's the beautiful thing, not just about exams, but about any kind of personal endeavour, that you explore different aspects of your capabilities and you extend and you improve them. And that's, to me, what is really exciting about anything like this, I mean, exams or climbing Everest or running a marathon or anything.
And that's what kind of rewarding and productive work should be, I think, for young people. If we look beyond exams, I'm not talking here about deliberately ramping up the pressure. I'm not interested in pressure for pressure's sake at all. You know, we need young people to be happy, positive, to have high levels of agency, efficacy, and confidence. That's just absolutely crucial. But good work is challenging work, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, and I think all the things you've talked about today, you know, having the vision, putting the effort in, systems, practice, attitude, and what I talk about all the time, consistency, is this long-term approach to an exam course. And it's not about those last 6 weeks or month or a fortnight before you actually take the exam, when the pressure suddenly goes up. If you take on all the things that you've been talking about today and that I talk about in my book and in my coaching sessions and all that kind of thing, then you have that consistent application to grow your ability, your understanding and your capabilities. And it's that is it's what we're looking for, and that's how you grow almost comfortably and without stress, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, growth means leaving behind a set of safe certainties and moving to a rather less certain set of circumstances, but over a period of time that certainty strengthens as you move into a new zone. So growth does mean, to a certain extent, leaving behind safe certainties and moving into uncharted waters. But my argument would be, stimulating and exciting employment post-university involves that kind of growth.
Definitely.
Leadership involves that kind of growth. Entrepreneurship involves that kind of growth. Creativity involves that kind of growth. I think this is essential to what makes us happy, productive, and positive human beings, ultimately.
Definitely. Yeah, that's a wonderful place, I think, probably to end this, because at the end of the day, exams are all about growing and moving on to that next level and enabling and facilitating that next chapter in your life. And if you're learning these personal skills about how to grow into a particular challenge when you're at school studying for your A-levels or even your GCSEs, then you will take that with you when you go to university and when you have your first job and move beyond in that kind of a way. So thank you so much, Martin. I think that's been so informative for parents, and it gives a real insight into what can be expected and how they can begin to set up their children for success at A-level and how they can support them to do that. Before you go, could you just tell us where people can find you online if they'd like to have a chat with you or maybe even buy your book?
Yeah, certainly. The book's called The A-Level Mindset and is written by my colleague Steve Oakes and me. My name's Martin Griffin. And that's available, I guess, at wherever books are sold.
Yep.
There's an A-Level Mindset student workbook that goes alongside it. The GCSE Mindset is due October of this year, so that will be coming out soon. 40 more activities to help students strengthen these non-cognitive aspects of their habits, behaviours and approaches to study. And if you're interested in getting in touch, we're on social media. We're on Twitter at A-Level Mindset. That's all one word, all lowercase, at A-Level Mindset, and you can say hello there and we'd be happy to chat.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put all those links in the show notes so that people can easily access them and come and find out more about you. But thank you so much for coming along today, Martin. It's been a really, really fantastic discussion.
Thanks, Lucy. Always a pleasure talking to you.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, wasn't that a great interview with Martin? He shared some real insights into how students can really step up after their GCSEs to the standard of A-level and really succeed. I found in my work as an academic coach and also as a teacher that students also often get tripped up at the beginning of their A-level studies because it is such a big step up. And I think in this educational climate, with the changes we've seen in GCSEs and A-levels, this year is going to be one of the hardest years ever, I think, for students to step up from GCSE to A-level. So listening to this episode is really important. If you need a little bit more support, though, with stepping up to A-level, I'd really invite you to consider taking part in my new course called the Exam Success Formula. It's an 8-week course for students and parents aimed at helping to give both of you the tools to really succeed in your exams. Now, it can be for anybody from year 10 up to year 13, so those 4 exam years where you're studying towards GCSEs or A-levels. But it's all about giving you the tools that you need to succeed. And it covers everything from motivation to time management to the mindset for success, to things like revision skills and how to plan revision and how to review revision and exam season after it's all over and done, so you can learn for next time. I think it's really important that students learn alongside their parents, and their parents really engage with this process as well, which is why I've made it into a course for both parents and students, so that you can really start to communicate with each other really clearly about your expectations and about your understanding, and you're basically both singing from the same hymn sheet. And by doing this, I hope that you will reduce the amount of nagging or conflict that goes on around revision and exams, and it can be a much more serene and more stress-free process than you might expect it to be otherwise. If you think this sounds interesting, something that would be really helpful in your house, I'd love you to check it out. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, which you can go and click on, and you'll find the information page all about the course. Or if you Google the Exam Success Formula, I'm sure you'll find it. The other way of finding it is going to my website, lifemoreextraordinary.com, and clicking on the Work With Me tab, and then you'll see a link to click through to the information page. So all it remains for me to say now is thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you spending your time with me today. If you've got any comments or questions about either the episode or the course, please just drop me an email at lucy@lifemoreextraordinary.com, or send me a tweet at Lucy C. Parsons. Or if you're a parent, come on over and join the private Facebook group for parents, which is called the Supportive Parents Successful Students Community. Finally, it will really help me to reach more people and give me feedback on whether I'm doing a good job with the podcast if you leave a review, and you can do that either in your podcast app or on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. Goodbye.